and welcome to a very special edition of the Smart Life podcast dedicated to World War Today. Today, we embark on what may be our most crucial and important conversation yet. We invite you to spend the next 40 minutes with us as we delve into the future of water sustainability and its growing importance in our daily lives. World War Today brings to the forefront the essential need for fresh water and sustainable management practices to face the challenges of the coming decade. We're looking at climate change, population growth, agricultural demands, urbanization, pollution, and the threats to our ecosystems. These factors contribute to an increasing water scarcity crisis, threatening global access to this vital resource.
However, amidst these challenges, there is a beacon of hope. Innovations and advancements in technology are paving the way for significant progress in water sustainability.
I'm Jess Hadley, and in today's episode, we'll be exploring how we can use technology to be more water sustainable. Here to talk to us today is Gert-Jan Mastam, partner at Blue North Partners, and Adam Williams, director at Nascent Growth Consultancy. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Jess. Hi, Gert-Jan.
Hello, both.
Before we dive in, Gert, could you tell me a little bit about yourself and your background in water preservation?
Yes, I can. Thanks, Jess. As you can hear, I'm Dutch, and the Dutch are, as you all know, very closely connected to water, because half of the country is below sea level. And in the last 25 years plus, I've been active in innovation, R&D on water in buildings and water in infrastructure. And about a year ago, I founded my own company, helping pioneers in water technology and climate technology to grow faster.
Fantastic. And you had...
Thanks, Gert. Yeah, and you've inspired me, actually, on my introduction to say, yeah, hi, I'm Adam Williams. I'm English, and we're also very closely connected to water because we're an island nation, but also because of our famous weather, which we love to spend all of our time talking about. But, I've come into this space most recently as a CEO of Hero Labs, who manufacture amazing water detection, metering, and leak prevention technology powered by AI. Yeah, there'll be more on that later. But really coming from a background of a passion for how connected technologies can improve, you know, the way we live in general. So, you know, through IoT, so-called IoT and AI powered technologies. Yeah, that's me.
Fantastic. Well, it's amazing to have you both on the podcast. So let's dive into our first question. So, could you describe the most pressing challenges in water scarcity that we face today and into the next few years, and move into a little bit on how climate change compound these challenges?
Yeah, if I could just jump on that one, I can quote my sources later, but for the interest of time, you know, it's generally accepted from research that by the middle of this decade, 2/3 of the world's population will be suffering water shortages and will be described as being in water scarcity regions. I mean, that's a really scary figure to me. When you think, well, hold on, we live on the blue planet, right? 2/3 of the world's surface is covered in water. How can that happen? It's not just down to climate change. It's down to how responsibly or irresponsibly we use the water that's available to us. Just throw some numbers for context. 97% of the world's water is not available to us for consumption as a species because it's seawater, it's not potable, or it's in the ground. That leaves 3% for us to play with. 2% of that is frozen. It's in ice caps, etc. So that leaves us just 1% of the world's available water to use, and we waste 70% of it in one form or another. Worldwide, 30% of all drinking water is lost to leaks. So, you know, that fundamentally we have to address every aspect of our relationship with water, not just alongside the momentum that's building on climate measures, but you know, as a species anyway, you know, with a growing population around the world, we have to find sustainable technologies at scale.
Yeah, those are stunning numbers, Adam. If I can further build on that, Jeff. In general, due to climate change, you could say that our infrastructure is heavily underinvested. It is underinvested anyway, but climate change is making it even worse. Well, the infrastructure is simply not adequate to deal with either drought or with flood risk, heavy rainfall. So underinvestment of infrastructure is a huge challenge that we face. And the transformation, the new technology required, that transformation is simply happening too slow. It's not going fast enough. The weather changes are happening faster than our ability to adapt the infrastructure.
Water is regarded by the majority of the world, not all of the world, but clean water is regarded as a fundamental human right, as it should be. But it's a commodity that we've almost, got so good at processing it that it's far too cheap for the value that it has. And so we literally take clean drinking water and flush it down the toilet. I mean, if you think about it, UK homes, they don't even have a secondary grey water cycle because the sewage systems that were built in Victorian times were designed in such a way that, to replace that infrastructure is extremely expensive. And there are, by the way, there are some amazing businesses out there, such as Hydroloop, who are solving that problem with retrofittable and new fittable technologies in homes to solve that. So there's hope. There is hope. We've started with a really, doom-laden beginning, but there's an enormous, most of this podcast, will be about what can be done and what is being done, and there is hope. But doing nothing is not an option for anybody, and leaving it to somebody else to solve is not an option for anybody. Don't wait for the government. Don't wait for the water authority. Equally, in your own home, there are things that we can all do that all contribute, cumulatively to solving the problem. But I think it's coming from a fundamental disconnect in the relationship between each of us and water that's just taken for granted. It's always been there. It'll always be there. It'll always come out of the tap. I'll always be able to drink it. And I'm paying less than penny a pint. And that's not going to be the case in the future.
Absolutely.
Yeah. To build on that, and indeed water is cheap. And that's a massive, or at least the perception is that water is cheap. And that's stopping from taking action. And another fundamental problem with water is a lack of regulations. And related to that, a complete lack of sense of urgency. Although everybody sees that, read your newspaper in the morning and 9 out of 10, there's water-related issues, whether it's flooding or whether it's Barcelona or Catalonia in Spain completely running out of water. It's in the headlines almost every day. Somewhere at the planet, there's a disaster happening water-related. But the sense of urgency is still too low, and it's shocking. I've been active in Latin America, a part of the world really suffering from lack of water as we speak, where there's water companies, as Adam just already highlighted, where the water that they produce, almost up to 60% of all the water produced is not reaching the tap. So it gets lost until it's what I call non-revenue water, water that is not invoiced to any customer. And yes, no measure action being taken.
What are the most promising water-saving technologies and innovations being developed right now? And can you talk to how these solutions address both the symptoms and the root causes of water scarcity, Jan?
Well, now we're moving a little bit to the story of hope that we hope we will bring you today, because it's not all about being gloomy and black about future of water and how we secure our planet living with water. But if you look at the most promising innovations and technologies, ways we use water and consume water, and again, if you look at water production, for example, there are digital technologies that have the ability to monitor the water networks where up to 60% of our water is leaking away, detect leakages when they occur, even when they're small and we don't see them or hear them or experience them, and take action on it. So that's very promising, available technology, ready to be rolled out and deployed everywhere. There is technologies on water consumption in agriculture, for example. We massively need food for a growing population in the world. But for producing food, we need an awful lot of water. And we can be way more efficient in the way we do so. And there are very, very promising technologies. Micro-irrigation, precise irrigation, where you just give enough water to grow the food in the most productive way without spoiling anything of it. And a technology that I'm really impressed with, you help farmers anywhere in the world to give them weather-steered information about their plot of land and their growth of crops, whether they need to add more water or can stop irrigation and save water for the next months when it's getting, for example, very dry. And that's going to have a massive impact on water consumption. There's technologies in industrial where we can use wastewater in a much more sustainable way and use water twice for the processes we work with. And I think Adam is an expert on water inside buildings and give powerful examples on what we can do there. So there's a variety, and it's not one solution. We have to deploy all of them in all the areas of water production and water usage if we want to secure water for future generations.
Yeah, thank you, Kurt-Jan. And exactly that, I was just going to pick up on, you know, a couple of, if I could plug a couple of companies just as examples of the kind of innovation that is, you know, really bringing a change. And like any technology, it deserves its place in the world. It has value if it solves a real and present problem in a way that's better than the traditional alternative. That's kind of my definition of new technology. So it's not like we're inventing, you know, flying cars for the Jetsons here. And again, you know, I'll raise a smile. My favorite quote, I do it just about every podcast, is William Gibson said, "The future's already here. It's just unevenly distributed." Yeah. So people are getting their head around sensor-based technologies. You know, we've got a lot of it in our lives and in our homes now, whether it's a video doorbell, whether it's a smart meter and, you know, electricity meter, whether it's a, you know, a thermostat that you can control through your phone. People are used to the idea that they've got connected technology and remote controls and remote monitoring. A lot of data comes off those systems. But, you know, until now, it hasn't really, nobody's really lent into water again because of what we said, it's too cheap. It's like, so what have I wasted? It doesn't cost me anything to waste. It doesn't cost me very much. If I could pick up on a couple of examples, I mentioned earlier already, you had a fantastic company called Hydraloop who have found a way to recycle the water that comes through your shower, you know, not the soiled water that goes into the sewage, you know, but pretty much everything else in your home can be used multiple times. Why not? If you're not planning to drink it, you know, it can be made perfectly clean inside that system with their technologies. Another company I'd like to pick out is a company called IP. The letters IPEE. Fantastic Belgian company that eliminates water waste in sanitary ware. So, you know, toilets, urinals, this kind of thing. Very simple concept that brilliantly executed. They put sensors that can be retrofitted into a range of brands. So name your, everybody knows a toilet brand, right? I'm not going to plug them here, but it can fit into virtually all of the ceramic ware of the world's leading sanitary ware, the Flush, extremely accurately using exactly the right amount of water based on an extremely accurate monitoring of the situation, even to the point where it knows if you're a gentleman and you're standing up in front of the toilet, then the Flush can be a lot smaller than if you've sat down for a length of time. So being able to measure all of those sorts of things can reduce water use in toilets and urinals by over 60%. And they have, now, if you bear in mind that approximately, it's estimated in the UK, approximately 1 in 10 toilets at any given time is leaking. 1 in 10. Now, I had a toilet fixed in my home that was leaking. It's just a small leak. You don't even know you've got it. And when I had it fixed, it reduced my daily water consumption by 300 liters a day. So if you do the maths on how many toilets there are in the UK, 10% of them are leaking, and that's costing 300 litres a day. It's very easy to run up the maths on how much water we can save with those kinds of technologies. And the other one I'd like to pull out, not for a plug, you know, my former company, Hero Labs, is a manufacturer of combined smart water meter with a stopcock that's connected to an app and a browser. And crucially, is powered by an AI platform. And so the third thing I'd like to draw out is AI, and I'll come to that in a second, the power of AI. And for once, a positive story of hope about AI, which, you know, sometimes the media focuses too much on the potential threats. You know, there are enormous benefits as well. But just talking about Hero Labs for a moment, you know, Hero Labs uses ultrasonic technology to measure extremely accurately the flow, and therefore can measure whether or not you've even got the tiniest, slowest of leaks. So it can say to you, hey, you might have that leaky loo I just talked about. For a very small amount of money, you can make a very big water waste saving that you didn't even know you had. But it can also help prevent you from having expensive leaks. Now, leaks cost insurance companies more payouts than any other home insurance claim combined, including fire, burglary, everything. It's an absolutely huge problem. So there we come back into the economic business case. You might not be so bothered about your slightly leaky loo. You absolutely care if you get a leak, you know, that destroys your new kitchen, and then you've got a big insurance claim, and the insurance company, you know, and generally speaking, insurance companies can offer 10 to 15% discounts on their insurance policies, you know, if you have this kind of technology installed. So there's a win-win. And so, you know, working with water companies, working with telcos, you know, for the broadband, for the data, working with insurance companies, etc., can deliver the business case that means those sorts of technologies get incorporated inside the buildings. I just want to say one other thing about AI as well. I said I'd big up AI, which you know, doesn't happen too often. Is AI powered water data, when combined with the other data that's available in buildings today, such as, you know, knowing whether people are coming and going, whether the door's been opened or closed, whatever, gives a three-dimensional, real-time view of human behavior, okay, particularly in buildings where those sensors are growing and being populated. Almost like the movie, The Matrix, you know, you can almost see the world through the data in real time. And that has enormous potential for everything from better building design, better retrofit solutions in social housing, all the way through to hotels, whatever else it might be. The better design of smart cities and living areas. So this is not just about saving a leak or even reducing the wastewater. It's about optimizing smart cities generally. So it's absolutely part of the sustainability agenda, because it powers, you know, with AI classifications, you're able to tell if that's a toilet flush or, you know, that's whatever. You do that at scale. You can even do things like much better elder care, because if, you know, Mavis, who's 87 years old, is getting out of bed three times a night, then maybe somebody should go take her temperature and see whether or not she's got a, you know, a kidney infection or whatever, see if she needs a bit of help. And you'll be able to pick those things up much sooner than when she starts saying she doesn't feel too well. So in a non-invasive way, this data has enormous potential into every aspect of life.
Absolutely. I mean, it's actually quite shocking or surprising that something that's so vital in how we function as humans is almost so, like you said, so taken for granted. And it's amazing how these technologies are basically giving knowledge its power and sort of making and forcing not only us as individuals, but businesses or farmers, like you mentioned, Gert-Jan, looking at the data and how they can just save more and implement more, because it will get more expensive eventually as it starts to become more and more scarce. So what are the main barriers to implementing these sort of water saving technologies on a global scale, have you found?
Well, we can write a book about it, and this podcast could be very lengthy talking about the barriers. But in general, well, mentioning a few big barriers, one is the strong focus on energy efficiency and energy savings. When people have to make choices, am I going to invest my money in energy or in water? The general perception is that energy is very expensive, and therefore making buildings sustainable, making the infrastructure sustainable, is all focused on energy. And our message, our experience is that's wrong. There are investments in water-saving technology where the payback, the business case, is way more appealing and attractive than in any energy-saving measurement that you can take inside a building, for example. So we have to, and World Water Day is the perfect stage for that message. We have to make a big shout that investment in water technology pays off and has a very appealing business case, even though water in the general eye is cheap and we take it for granted. It's paying off with a payback that can be, depending on the choice, depending on the location, because that's important to keep in mind. Location matters because the price of water is very different depending on where you are in the UK or where you are in Europe or where you are in the world. The price of water is way different depending on where you are. But in general, investing in water efficiency pays off and has a payback between half a year, 2-3 years, if you pick the right technology, and that's way better than most of the widely adopted investments in energy efficiency can deliver.
It sounds like it's actually such an easy quick win with climate change that we could be just adopting some of these things and actually we'd start to feel some of the positive impact, which I feel from a sort of generalized standpoint is more likely to make us feel like we can adopt and tackle other areas of climate change if we were
absolutely
these new technologies.
Yeah, they are combined. I just wanted to make that point that the irony is the biggest use of energy, and today that means fossil fuels, in homes, largely, certainly in the UK and most Western, developed countries, is the heating of water, especially where we have wet central heating. So, the two things are conflated, and I guess some of the barrier, but the way over the barrier is to ride that wave, pardon the terrible pun, of the climate change movement. Because in my whole adult life, we've been waiting for that thing to get momentum. Let's use that momentum. I have to make a small joke as well and say, I think the most powerful message of this entire podcast, and I would suggest is the title of the book that Gert-Jan should write, is that investing in water tech pays off. It's that simple. We're at the point where we've crossed, where the lines on the graph pass, and it's just good business. It's just good business.
It is. Yeah. If you don't do it for the planet, do it for your wallet. Basically, that's the message. And Jess, your question was about barriers. Well, one, energy, the focus on energy is one. Conservatism and a lack of digital adoption, because Adam made the point that data and digital, it's all about having information and steering your choices and your behavior based on the information and the data that you can have. But conservatism and a lack of digital or a slow and low digital adoption is another barrier that we see happening, whether it's in agriculture, farmers that don't trust data and digital, or it's in construction, or digital adoption must go. Lack of regulations, already mentioned. Regulations do matter, and the UK is an example where water regulations are now being implemented, because there are water stressed areas in the UK where we have to take action, and regulations are coming up. Where, for example, in a district like Horsham, you're only allowed to build new buildings if you compensate the amount of water that those buildings will consume in the same region. So that's going to have a massive impact on water technologies being implemented. But those are exceptions. So we need more regulations if we want to preserve water anywhere in the world. So that's a barrier. In general, short-term thinking, I think in general, it's very human that we try to stick to the day of today or tomorrow. And water is about, the long-term future. So we need to take a long-term perspective. on water. And again, there the good news is that you see big corporate companies now deploying water strategies in all the places in the world where they're active, because they see that their businesses can only survive if they secure availability of water. And that's a very promising development. And there you talk about big breweries, Heineken, Coca-Cola, cement companies, Procter & Gamble, IT companies with data centers consuming a lot of water, who all start to consider that they have to massively invest in water-saving technologies in order for their businesses to survive.
I mean, that's incredible that actually, in a sense, that it's going to be potentially the technology companies themselves having to implement and sort of show the way, because ultimately it won't be sustainable for businesses. Like you mentioned, data centers is a massive one that uses high consumption water, breweries. They're going to need that to have a future in business. So in general, so we looked at those as the barriers. Obviously, one of the big ones was sort of lack of adoption or lack of awareness. In your experiences, what strategies have been effective in raising awareness and securing buy-in from both the public for water conservation initiatives, but also business? And how do we best educate everyone, as well as the consumers, but also businesses and government, on what the issues are and what we can do and what the opportunities are for us all if we can sort of buy into implementing these new technologies? I mean, Adam, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it will be, picking up on the point, the tail of the last discussion, you know, largely private sector led. If we break down three groups, you've got groups that will make decisions for good, sound business reasons. And that's not just profit. You know, I know we like to, you know, always fall on that. It's not just a good business case, but the business cases also carry increasingly, you know, private sector businesses like to be responsible and be the leaders on implementing technologies. So I think, you know, it's a bit of an irony that it's the big data centers that are now using huge amounts of water, but they're the very people who understand the technology that could solve this or that would be more likely to invest in it. You know, and there's this great new KPI in lots of businesses called ESG. People are taking, you know, environmental social governance extremely seriously. And so I think creating I think I mentioned it earlier, we need to create a new currency for water, for water conservation and for clean water preservation and this kind of thing, and availability to people, especially in poorer countries and poorer parts of society. If that currency was wrapped up in this idea of businesses, you know, investing in these technologies for the long term because they're in a position to do that, I think that's a key part of what will drive this. You know, we've seen this resurgence just in the last year or two, really, around B Corp. You know, where are the water sustainability certificate or standard kite mark to be a B Corp? I think we'll see a lot more of that coming, where people say, okay, you know, we'll invest in these technologies within our own buildings and in our products and in our services, and then we'll insist on our suppliers meeting those standards. It's exactly the same as all of the initiatives around, you know, fair trade or, you know, non-recyclable plastic. It needs to go up the supply chain as well. I think that will be led by business, to be honest. I think it will be technology led. As we said, we've got the sharp end of the innovators like IP and Hero Labs and Hydroloop, etc. We've got the innovators in the infrastructure sections that Gert Jan can speak with far greater authority than me. So now we come to the humble member of the public. I mean, I remember when I was a young lad, really, there were adverts on TV saying, if you want a cup of tea, only put one cup of water in the kettle. Why? And that was partly about saving energy, but it's also about not wasting water. So this has been around, you know, I've got the gray beard. This has been around for, you know, 3 or 4 decades, certainly across my life. Ladies don't really change until you get things like hosepipe bans, you know, and then there's a social pressure. So, you know, I think there is an education piece here. I don't think you can just use a stick. I don't think you just raise prices and regulate and limit supply, because that doesn't, history shows that doesn't drive the right behaviors. I think there need to be, I think most people, when made more aware of, you know, the impact that they can have. It's the same with recycling. Look at how many years people didn't they just put everything in one black bin, you know, and now people are quite fastidious. Yeah. My kids tell me off about not separating the recycling out into the correct bins, you know. So that, there's hope that if we get the awareness right, then I think we have a movement. Yeah. That's my view.
Absolutely.
Yeah, to build on that, on that view, and Adam gave quite a few powerful examples of you know, innovations and companies that do a great job in offering solutions that can be deployed tomorrow with a very good payback. But up to now, I think there are very few examples of policy communication or educating which result in massive change of behavior. And it's also very difficult to do so. If you look at energy and the big energy transformation that happened recently was when the energy prices went through the roof, and all of a sudden people could no longer pay their energy bills, or saw that a big chunk of their wallet was all of a sudden occupied by energy costs. And then all of a sudden, everybody started to look at, you know, heat pumps or insulation of homes. How can I reduce my or changing behavior? You know, putting the temperature in your room 1.5 degree lower than you're used to. With water, my prediction is the same will happen. You know, the urgency and the problems will become so big. If you look at Catalonia or Spain today, where there is no more water, you know, people are changing. Look at Cape Town. A couple of years ago, was reaching day zero, and day zero was meant the day where there would no longer be water available for the population. That was the day zero that they saw coming up, which all of a sudden resulted in massive behavioral change. All of a sudden, everybody started to be responsible in the way they were using water. And so that's going to be the biggest behavioral change. And in addition to that, information and data. If people understand how much time did I... One of the companies I love is a company called Aguardio, and they've developed a shower app that does nothing more than telling you how much time you've used the shower this morning. And just that, applied in hotels, reduces the water consumption by 25%. Business case, you earn it back.
So no time. Yeah.
Hotels all over the world, this is a no-brainer. Apply it, earn it back, good for your wallet, but it's good for the planet. It secures water because all of a sudden, because people get information that they did not have yesterday, and they reduce the time they shower by 25%, which, by the way, also saves energy.
I'd like to just reinforce that. You know, at Aero Labs, we find that just having that app in your hand and being able to see, you know, it doesn't bother you all the time, but being able to see people, there's that OMG moment. Every time I tell people, how much water do you think you use? People say, oh, I don't know, 50 or 60 litres. I say, well, the average household uses 450 litres. And people go, that's like a swimming pool. You know, it's like people can't relate. And when you show them it broken down and go, well, a 5-minute shower, you know, do you really need to clean your teeth in the shower? I mean, come on, you know, but you, joking apart, that behavior change, we were seeing 15% plus reductions across the whole home, you know, just from the kinds of things Gert-Jan's pointing out, just by giving people that accurate AI classified data that enables you to say, yeah, that's a shower, and you were in it for 3.5 minutes. It's not about shaming. It's not about having a stick. It's about informing and educating. But Gert-Jan's also right that as prices rise, you know, but we need to stay ahead of that curve. The technology needs to be ready by the time the consumer's ready, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. And it's going to be more impactful if we can learn from what's going already on out in different areas of the world and implement it quicker. And, you know, I was going to say that people are inherently good. They want to make these changes, but they just don't know. And so putting this data into their hands and making them aware of it, like say they automatically, you know, all of the technology you've mentioned, once people had seen it or once it's being adopted and used, there's an instant reduction. So it's just getting the data to them. And so, I mean, that kind of moves me on, is how critical is it going to be for governments to bring in policy interventions to facilitate this adoption of water-saving technologies without, if we want to stop this happening by the prices rising and it's become absolutely necessary, if we want to implement something beforehand, is that going to be the job of the government go?
Big time.
I think Adam just made clear that businesses are taking their responsibility now. And that's very good to see, and already resulting in massive change. But ultimately, governments have to take their responsibility and have to deploy regulations that steer technologies and solutions that are out there in order to secure the long-term future of water. And you know, one UK example, water-related. In the UK, one of the biggest water challenges is pollution of surface water, because the sewers are not able to absorb high amounts of rainfall due to climate change. In the UK alone, there's 300,000 spills of sewers a year, resulting in heavy surface water pollution. Changing that big time in a fundamental way is asking for governments to change regulations and to deploy regulations that enforce taking action.
So based upon our getting our governments to act, who is best placed to start lobbying? Is it going to be consumers and the general public, or should it be businesses, or a combination of the two that's going to help us get them to enact this change? Because they must be aware of what's going on, but it's not become a priority yet.
There isn't one answer to that, Jess, but I'm also a board trustee of the Electrical Safety Board in the UK, and it's a similar situation, which is, you know, people are dying or being injured or having their property damaged by, you know, electrical safety issues, you know, and recently they've done some amazing campaigns on things like e-bikes and e-scooters, you know, catching fire, you know, and that sort of thing. And so, you know, my view from there is legislation is a slow moving, relatively blunt and imprecise way of dealing with a problem. But when you get that change, it benefits everybody. So it's worth pursuing, but you've got to have people in a position to navigate and influence and cajole and coach and lobby, you know, in that direction. So I think there are a number of, you know, interested parties to do that. I think number one would be things like the charitable sector or the not-for-profit sector, I would say, environmental groups, these kinds of people, apply pressure in a respectful and legal manner. You know, I'm not suggesting, you know, extreme activism. Then you've got the ones that Jan's touched upon, you know, agricultural technology. They need to have the incentives in the form of whether it's tax breaks or grants for new types of farming technology that deliver these benefits, in the same way that in the 70s and 80s in the UK, we were paying people to regenerate biodiversity in the farming community and the guardians of the landscape and not the destroyers of the landscape, you know, so you've got to move in that direction. And then I think business will be ultimately one of the most powerful lobby groups, which says, you know, we need a framework within which open competition and innovation can be allowed to thrive to bring the solutions that we need. And, you know, I am actually in that area seeing some really good work being done by grants being made available in various countries around Europe. I mean, Gert-Jan will know more about this than me, but, you know, the UK, there are R&D grants and that sort of thing. So there are incentives in place by government, but there just needs to be a lot more of it. And I think that the lobbying for governments to do more will come from, you know, probably those groups above and beyond the others, would be my view. Gert-Jan, I don't know if you'd agree.
I would like to, I fully agree with that. And I like to add NGOs to that.
Yes.
They can play a very powerful role in lobbying because they see and feel and experience the problems, the challenges and the future scarcity that we will face. And one example that I experienced was in Guatemala, where there was an NGO that was measuring the water levels in a number of wells, 300 wells, water wells around the capital. And they were measuring that the water level in those wells was dropping alarmingly, because they consistently were measuring it over a period of several years, and used those data, those facts, create awareness at government level that they had to do something and had to take action. So NGOs do play a role and have a role to play. But there are also several sectors like hotels, where you see that leading hotel chains around the world are now actively investing in water-saving technology without any regulation enforcing that. Because they see that for their business to survive, they have to do that. And they are taking action. So it's a combination.
It almost, like you're saying, Gert-Jan, earlier when you were saying how there's an economic benefit to doing this. And it's not just the preservation of a business. It's also the growth sector, maybe how we grow the economies across Europe, which, you know, have been suffering over the last few years, is by doing all of this, is by actually getting behind and getting government to recognize, hey, if you want to grow the economy, if we're going to do better, we've got to invest in this kind of technology and take it as a forerunner. And that might make them a bit more interested, I guess, in it. In a sense, that gives us a good way to sort of go to our last question, which is, looking ahead, what gives you hope about our ability to address water scarcity? And can you envisioned a future where water resources are managed sustainably and equitably, and if so, what does that future look like?
Shall I start with that?
Please do. I was hoping you would.
Yeah. Well, why would we be hopeful about a world dealing sustainably with water? One very obvious reason is investment in water technology pays off. That's the first part of the story of hope. The second one, Adam and I are working with pioneers, small and large, in water and climate technology that do amazing things with new technology. New technology required, essential in order to drive the transformation that the world is looking for. The good thing is that there is a growing willingness to fund those pioneers. So there is a lot of investment money now available to develop technologies and to make them grow. And a lot of clever engineers that are developing the technologies that we need so desperately. And then regulations are coming in place and will come in into place more and more and more because it's unavoidable. Mm-hmm. And then the last element, Adam already mentioned it, ESG. The EU is forcing now companies to report on the performance, their ESG performance. And that's about energy, but it's also about water. How are we using water? How are we managing to reduce consumption or reuse the water in the example that Adam gave with Hydraloop? Use water twice. You know, collect your shower water, clean it, and use it again. So ESG will heavily change behavior, will enforce companies to perform better year after year. And water is going to be one of the focal areas in those ESG reports.
I genuinely can't agree on that. I think you've covered all the bases. I think all I'd say is, you know, from my perspective, I'm very optimistic. The sector is moving. It's alive with innovators. We're seeing the metrics for business aligning with these things. With the right investment, the right regulatory environment, the business case is extremely viable for the mass uptake of these new solutions, whether that's into the new built environment. And by that, I don't just mean buildings. I mean the whole infrastructure, urban infrastructure and rural and agricultural infrastructure as well. But also into existing infrastructure in terms of retrofit and, you know, the endpoint devices. And we didn't even touch in this whole podcast on the amazing work we're seeing from appliance manufacturers, you know, washing machines, dishwashers, all of those things as well. And we're seeing these technologies transform, you know, efficient water use in those spaces as well. So there's a movement now. So hopefully we started with scary numbers and we're finishing with hope and optimism. But that hope and optimism will only turn into the reality for us all if everybody takes it upon themselves to raise their own awareness and the awareness of others and to do something. Yeah, just, you know, we need action. That's why. Yeah, that's my last word. Yeah.
We need action fast. We need to be faster.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I just want to say a massive thank you. Like you both, we started this podcast with episode with some very scary figures, but we're finishing it off with a lot of optimism and a lot of hope for the future. It's thank you for your call to arms to everybody on this World Water Day to get involved and to start thinking about how they could be taking part, but also will be in government. And really having a look at addressing the issue. So I just want to say thank you again for joining and being so informative and insightful. And it's been a fantastic episode. So thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jess.
You're very welcome. Yeah, thank you, Jess. It's been great fun. Thanks for inviting us.